to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 133 in The Mysterious and the Communal, part 5. Again, reading from God is Red, Native View of Religion by Bynum Lauria Jr., published by Fulcrum. And for this intro, I'm just going to read the paragraph from whence I plucked the title of this audio series. A substantial portion of every tribe remains solidly within the Christian tradition by having attended mission schools. They grew up in a period of time when any mention of tribal religious beliefs was forbidden, and they have been taught that Indian values and beliefs are superstitions and pagan beliefs that must be surrendered before they can be truly civilized. They stand, therefore, in much the same relationship to the tribal religion as educated liberals now stand to the Christian and Jewish religions. Both groups have lost their faith in the mysterious, the transcendent, the communal nature of religious experience. They depend on a learned set of ethical principles to maintain some semblance of order in their lives. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Before getting to the chapters in order, just I'm going to continue with the next couple of paragraphs here, because it sums up much of the book and the series and what's going on in today's world. A great many Indians reflect the same religious problem as do the young whites who struggled through the last several decades of social disorder. They are somehow forced to hold in tension beliefs that are not easily reconciled. They have learned that some things are true because they have experienced them, that others are true because everyone seems to agree that they are true, and that some things are insoluble and cannot be solved by any stretch of the imagination. One of the primary aspects of traditional tribal religions has been the secret ceremonies, particularly the vision quests, the fasting in the wilderness, and the isolation of the individual for religious purposes. This type of religious practice is nearly impossible today. The places currently available to people for vision quests are hardly isolated. Jet planes pass overhead. Some traditional holy places are the scene of strip mining. Others are adjacent to superhighways. Others are parts of ranches, farms, shopping centers, and national parks and forests. The struggle of the Taos people to get their sacred Blue Lake away from the Department of Agriculture indicates the tenuous nature of some tribal religious practices in a world of complicated transportation services and radio and television.
Starting with chapter 12, the group. This was after the human personality, the group. The Christian religion's doctrine of creation was developed very early and is fundamental to the articulation of the basic Christian theology. It has been absorbed into the general set of assumptions about the nature of the world so that few people concern themselves with the implications. Subsequent expansion of the Christological doctrines has been so extensive that their relationship to the doctrine of creation has been largely ignored or forgotten. It may be unnecessary also to place much expectation on a renewal of the examination of history by adherents of the Christian religion. The linear conception of history as an exclusively European franchise has been so secularized and in recent years so militarized that it is no longer a wholly Christian phenomenon. While Christians abstractly maintain that God rules history, as we have seen, there is no great tendency to identify exact events in which the control of history is exercised. Instead, the more Christians appear to confront the problems involved with historical interpretations, the more they shy away from maintaining that any specific event has been the scene of divine activity. History, at least in its most concrete sense, has become largely a symbolic and parabolic matter. And a bit farther down, he's talking about the Old Testament and goes on with it. Even within the ethical systems of the later prophets of the Hebrew religion, however, the chosen people concept did not spill out from its ethnic boundaries. Isaiah and Jeremiah are more concerned with Israel's example as a people to the nations of the world than with a universal ethic humanism in which secular Judaism has lapsed. To read that again. More concerned with Israel's example as a people to the nations of the world than with a universal ethic humanism into which secular Judaism has lapsed. The absence of missionaries indicates that while the conception of God, particularly the God of Israel, may have narrowed in the centuries before the advent of Christianity, there is no impelling reason within the Hebrew religion to convert non-Hebrews to the religion of the nation. So there's where he's talking about the an example of as a people to the nations of the world. They're kind of being their own group, being themselves, and compared to the whole obvious proselytizing, colonizing that has ran rampant over the globe. And it made me wonder, as a Kabbalist, knowing Kabbalah, as translated as the personally received teaching, it made me wonder if the Kabbalah was hijacked to the personally received was hijacked to then a religious chosen, since that is sort of often referred to as the chosen people, that sort of projected outward to try to convert other people. And some other Judeo-Christian bits. The crisis that ensued in the doctrine of the chosen people with the advent of Christianity was a profound. If Jesus were really the Messiah and John the Baptist were Elijah, then Judgment Day should have come with the death of Jesus or shortly thereafter. Such was not the case. The community of Jesus' followers lingered on in Jerusalem for many years after his death, and it was apparently on the edge of starvation when Paul discovered their plight and sought contributions for them in Asia Minor. Inherent in the Jerusalem community state was the problem of the salvation of a few of the Jews who had followed Jesus, and the subsequent damnation of the remainder of the Jews who had not heeded his preaching. It was essential to hold the Jerusalem community intact to maintain that the Jews had rejected their status as chosen people and that the real meaning of Jesus' life and death had been to open the gates of salvation to non-Jews. This struggle began as Paul developed his theology and the subsequent doctrines of creation, history, and atonement. Without these doctrines, preaching to the Gentiles would have been futile, as they could not have been saved at any cost. The Christian God thus became dislocated not only in time and space, but also ethnically. In opening the religion of Gentiles, the whole conception of the chosen people was radically changed from an identifiable group or nation to a mysterious conglomerate of people who could not be identified with any degree of accuracy. I suppose interesting in light of the what we know of the natives as tribes or nations. And he goes on, perhaps the most standard definition of the church that has been advanced by Christian theologians is the body of Christ. That is to say, the historical aspects of Jesus as an identifiable human being were early consumed by the development of the idea of the church as the invisible body of the Christ. No one knew or could know who belonged to it until the final judgment, when everything would be revealed. As a community then, and as a community to be identified as the Jews had once identified themselves nationally, the Christian church was virtually invisible during its ascendancy to political equality in the Roman Empire. Well, that reminds me of the recent series of Sheldon Wolin's book and the recent series, Inverted Totalitarianism, how the... You know, the way he says the Christian church was virtually invisible during its ascendancy to political equality, how this sort of de-religiousness or, you know, de-spiritualness of what we expect of, say, Christian religion or whatever, it then gets diluted and in that sense it becomes, in a way, more dangerous sociologically and politically. Deloria continues, as the empire began to disintegrate, the only institution to which people could cling was the Christian church. It had adopted the basic political structure of the old Roman administrative apparatus and transformed it into an ecclesiastical hierarchy. And this reminded me too of the recent news of some of the uprisings of the neo-Nazi stuff and extremist tendencies, as some online articles depicted, was that the economic situation was so bad in certain countries that then the people look to, to identify with someone, some group, and so they look to a sort of extremist or neo-Nazi bent to sort of have an identity and to get some stuff from the system. By the end of the first Christian millennium, the church hierarchy had established itself as the supreme ruler of Europe. By cleverly combining a claim to divine sanction with the ambitions of rising European political leaders and the need of these leaders for divine sanctions to their authority, the professional clergy was able to solidify itself as a favored group within the continent's dominant feudal system. As the trend toward strong national governments increased, the church was able to protect itself by expanding its function to account for the changing conditions. Ecclesiastical courts were thus set up to maintain a favored position for church officials in the face of the development of the kingdom's secular courts. And with the Protestant Reformation, the Christian church was shattered into a number of national organizations, each claiming a direct relationship with the essential teachings of the Christian religion, to the other's detriment and degradation. Again, the concept of the church as the body of Christ was emphasized as the symbol of the community of believers. Community of believers, but again, and the most important aspect of the church was the visible organization assuming command of people's religious lives to the degree that each church claimed primacy in delivering divine commands. It also placed less emphasis on religious experience itself and concentrated on the discipline needed to maintain itself politically and economically. So again, he's pointing out this sort of major disconnect from true religion or spirituality, and the emphasizing of the political and the economical, and also, you know, the disconnect from the land, and the mentioning of religious, political, and economical in one sentence there, of course, again, brings me to that word that I find to sum up much of what goes on, the theofascism. And here he's saying less emphasis on religious experience, accentuating political and economical. I guess you kind of see that today. I mean, in some ways, people are beginning again to explore, you know, meditation and healing techniques. It's becoming in somewhat trendy, but a good sign of people once again looking for their own way aside, the institution aside. Later on, he's got a talking about radical evangelical churches. He says conservative Christianity today resembles nothing less than a religious auxiliary of the Republican Party. Until temporary Christian denominations recognize the human reality of ethnicity, they will continue to blunder in and out of contemporary situations and emerge worse for the experience. In the history of the early Hebrew people, we find a concern for the maintenance of national identity as a religious function. And in both groups, we find the same concern to show hospitality to a stranger as taking on an aspect of religious duty. talking about Cheyenne here. So there's a hospitality to a stranger instead of the convert the stranger. I was certainly pleased to read about the Hebrew sort of Hebrew version of all my relations here. It is respect to the attitude displayed toward strangers that a community's psychic identity can be determined. A community that is uncertain about itself must act in self-defense against any outsider to prevent any conceivable threat to its existence. Whereas a community that is a stable identity accords to other communities the dignity of the distinct existence that it wishes to receive itself. The admonition of the early Hebrews to honor the stranger in their midst because they were once strangers in Egypt indicates the degree of community security enjoyed by the people. Their faith in the continuity of their nation precluded the destruction of others simply because they have different customs and beliefs. Well, that right there, I think, is in a nutshell of much of the world and history, and extended not only to the two-leggeds but to all the relations. And you have a big picture there. And reading that, that makes me want to say, why is that not? I went to Passover Seders as a child, and I have not been for many, many years. But that seems like that was not in there. The admonition of the early Hebrews to honor the stranger in their midst because they were once strangers in Egypt. It's like, instead of just that they supposedly escaped, you know, where's the honoring stranger? I hope that's in there. I don't know for sure. And further emphasizing this, Deloria writes, yet religious wars are avoided because of the recognition that other peoples have special powers and medicines given to them, thus precluding an exclusive franchise being issued to any one group of people. So we get this franchise. The word franchise just stirs to me the whole, the whole modern corporate chain. I mean, the dominance of McDonald's and those type of places as a franchise under the banner of, under the banner of converting the sort of the economically heathen or what have you. And once again, I'll plug my book, Drive Through Theofascism and the Hero's Journey. The deep respect given here is what I take from these, starting to be a recurring theme in the shows as I go over this book, is the respect for other peoples. And you know, in some psychological sense, he's highlighting how the more one is secure with oneself, and the more one knows one's own talents and can recognize the talents or medicines or powers of others, there is a way to get along rather than to fight. And another aspect of the fascist government here, the Indian Reorganization Act made some restoration of tribal religion possible by abolishing the rules and regulations that forbade the practice of tribal religions on the reservations. By creating corporate forms of government for political and economic ends, however, the federal government created the same problems of religious confusion in the Indian tribes that existed in America at large. A good deal of the political turmoil on the reservations today is between traditional people and more assimilated people over the use of land and resources. Traditional people generally want to use land in the same way as did their ancestors, while the more assimilated people want to use it as an economic resource. The question that emerges is whether land is a thing to be used to generate income or a homeland on which people are supposed to live in a sacred manner. And there's a crux of a lot of what's going on today as well. And the sort of the post-traumatic stress disorder of what is being worked through with the divide and conquer, and now the natives, you know, coming again to reestablish their ways, but, you know, still compensating for the cost of the genocide, assimilation, etc. And Deloria continuing, only with the use of Hebrew by the Jewish community, which in so many ways perpetuates the Indian tribal religious conceptions of community, do we find contemporary similarities. Again, the conception of group identity is very strong among the Jews, and the phenomenon of having been born in a complete cultural and religious tradition is present, though many Jews, like many Indians, refuse to acknowledge their membership in an exclusive community. Then he gets into the technical stuff, the conflict, tax exemption of Christian churches, and that whole thing, George Carlin pointed out. in a humorous way about, you know, would American Christianity be able to continue without its tax exemption? That's a good thing to look at. I mean, you look at that, the whole system. Talk about recently all the bailouts and the subsidies for bank, you know, bank workers. I mean, in bank subsidies and the bailouts of the fast food industry subsidized by tax money. Just, you know, seeing that the whole system is not really, it's a delusion. It's not even capitalism. It's delusory capitalism. It's crony rigged capitalism with all the subsidies and tax exemptions and all that bullshit. So it's, what else can be said? I don't know. And then in a footnote, he's got, finishing up this chapter here, when the case on church tax exemption came to court, the attorneys general of 39 states filed amicus curiae briefs supporting continued exemption of the churches. The alleged separation of church and state does not seem so separate after all. In chapter 13, Christianity and Contemporary American Culture, this is the one that I said got a bunch of kind of one-liners where Deloria shows off, just my wording there, shows off the native sense of humor. He's got talking about the Congregational Church in Virgins, Vermont, provided a credit card machine at the entrance of the church to allow parishioners to charge their gifts to the Lord. The Virgins is literally flooded with credit cards, the Reverend Richard Ogden stated, and since we are moving into a credit card age, there's no reason the church should remain aloof. And then this is Deloria. Theologically, perhaps MasterCard would be most suitable. And later on, he's got talking about the First Baptist Church in Hammond, Indiana. Did not get its credit card machine in time, but it did get a fleet of buses to bring people to the church door. It owns a fleet of 108 buses carrying parishioners, and the budgets run close to $80,000 for the fleet of buses. And then he quotes the guy here, I think so much to building church growth through transportation that I'm spending my life working with buses rather than pastoring a church, and I have no regrets. And then Deloria adds, at least he must figure when you save a bus, it stays saved. Here's a highlighted paragraph that instead of observing other religions and finding that they are close to Christianity, Christians would be wise to begin a search for religious experience and certainty itself, regardless of the consequences. If there is no means by which the modern world can come into religious integrity, we should accept our condition and shoulder our responsibility of humane treatment of one another as victims of an incomprehensible universe. But if we find our way religiously, we should have the courage to accept the revelation that comes and live in the manner it commands us. Well, a lot going on there, but what I get from that is, like, just forget all, I mean, even without all the religious stuff, just you forget all that stuff and labels and blah, 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 and just treat people humanely. Just start treating people humanely. It's like cuts through all the nonsense. And then he's highlighting the rise of New Age spiritualism has most definitely intruded into the behavior patterns of contemporary Christianity. Winding up this chapter, he writes, all of these things taken together make it seem as if we are now approaching a time when a new kind of religion will make itself manifest to us. If we view all of this struggling for meaning in a world in which institutions and beliefs are rapidly eroding, then it seems likely that people are merely sorting out the correlation between beliefs and experiences. Thus, the religions that depend on the articulation of doctrinal propositions to maintain themselves are doomed to disappear beneath their own silliness. Those religious traditions that depend primarily upon invoking some kind of experience that is qualitatively distinct from everyday feelings will become the vehicles for religious expression in the future. All of this is to say that we will continue to see unqualified nonsense as the major product of the Christian churches. Jimmy and Tammy Faye Baker are only the first of the clowns to enter the arena. Can't help but think again that Deloria would really appreciate some of the Daily Show and Colbert Report and all that stuff. And chapter 14, Tribal Religions and Contemporary American Culture. And again, he's saying that we've seen some examples of the deviations created in religious behavior when a culture defines a religion. So again, it's like this watered-down religion compared to the real experience of religion, or what some call spirituality. Yeah, let's see. Let's try to just read some other bits to wind up this show here. This is part five. By the time of the Allotment Act of 1887, or Dawes Act, almost every form of Indian religion was banned on the reservations. In the schools, the children were punished for speaking their own language. Anglo-Saxon customs were made the norm for Indian people. Their efforts to maintain their own practices were frowned on, and stern measures were taken to discourage them from continuing tribal customs. Even Indian funeral ceremonies were declared to be illegal, and drumming and any form of dancing had to be held for the most artificial of reasons. So here's where he's talking about the some of them, to maintain their traditions, sort of, you know, sort of piggybacked on certain days like Memorial Day or George Washington Day, and so they would do their some of their ceremonial stuff as a way to maintain their culture, but you know, as a way to sneak it in, so to speak, on the American holidays or Christian religious days. So that's some thinking there. It has the Lummi Indians from Western Washington continued some of their tribal dances under the guise of celebrating the signing of their treaty. The Plains Indians eagerly celebrated the 4th of July because it meant they could often perform Indian dances and ceremonies by pretending to celebrate the signing of the Declaration of Independence. In 1934, under the Indian Reorganization Act, Indian people were finally allowed religious freedom. The missionaries howled in protest, but the ban on Indian religious ceremonies was lifted. Traditional Indians could no longer be placed in prison for practicing old tribal ways. Ceremonies began to be practiced openly, and there were still enough older Indians alive that a great deal of tribal religious traditions were regained. The great black elk, today perhaps the best remembered of the Sioux holy men, was still alive in 1934. It is said that he had frequent conferences with the holy men from other parts of the tribe living on different reservations. For several decades, the tribal religions held their own in competition with the efforts of the Christian missionaries, but a whole new generation had grown up, educated in mission and government schools, and living according to the bureaucrats' dictates. These young Indians rigorously rejected old religious activities as a continuation of paganism. Yet as more Indians went off the reservations, went to war, attended college, and lived in the cities, the situation began to change. The Indian people had always been somewhat in awe of Western technology. It seemed to imply that their God was more powerful than their tribal religions and medicine. The great expansion of the American Indian horizon in the 1950s had a tremendous effect on attitudes toward tribal religions, which provided a very important link with the tribal past. Often through healing ceremonies performed by the holy people of the tribe, sicknesses were cured that urban white doctors could not cure. In one decade, many American Indians began to see that whites and their Christian religion had fatal flaws. In the last several decades, tribal religions have seen a renewal that astounds many people. Pueblos of New Mexico and the Navajos of Arizona managed to retain much of their ceremonial life. The Hopi in particular preserved many of their ceremonies with relative purity. The Apaches also kept a number of their tribal ceremonies. In the Northwest, some of the tribes kept their ceremonies by holding them in secret on the isolated reservations, lacking sufficient federal resident staff to prohibit them. One of the greatest hindrances to the reestablishment of tribal religions is the failure of Indian people to understand their own history. The period of cultural oppression in its severest form, 1887 to 1934, served to create a collective amnesia in contemporary people. Too many Indians look backward to the treaties, neglecting the many laws and executive orders that have come to define their lives in the period since their first relationship with the United States was formed. Tribal people are in the unenviable position of dealing with problems, the origins of which remain obscured to them. The closest parallel that we find in history to the present condition of Indians is the diaspora of the Jews following the destruction of the temple. A surprising number of Indian activists have made this comparison without considering that the exile of the Jews was for a significant period of time, and that the Jewish people almost immediately developed a strong scholarly tradition to preserve their ceremonies and beliefs in exile. The Indian exile is, in a sense, more drastic. The people often live less than 100 miles away from their traditional homelands. Yet, in the relative complexities of reservation and urban life, they might be 2,000 or more years apart. It is not simply a spatial separation that has occurred, but a temporal one as well. And here he mentions divination and foretelling the future were once major parts of religion. With the coming of Christianity, they appear to have lost their respectability. Discovering the future was once a major function of tribal religious leaders. It remains today as one of the major strengths of traditional religious people. So they're, you know, interesting of the past, present, and future have got the native peoples having to, in a way, look back at the law, you know, the white man's laws, and figure out how to untangle themselves while also staying connected with their, you know, future telling traditions. And just wrapping up this section in a way, why I cherish these books, because, you know, from some that I've learned from talking with Native peoples and via the books and radio shows and such like, you know, there has to also be a respect for their traditions and the, in a way, the privacy of that, because, you know, they've been so harangued and maligned by outsiders that, you know, it's really important to not just sort of expect or demand that you'll get something from them, but to, you know, to give the respect that their traditions teach to how you treat others. And so here he's finishing this chapter by talking about the whole New Age phenomena. A warning light should flash when the Indian practitioners say that their elders told them to go out into the world and teach the traditional ceremonies. If one were to gather the great number of Indians now alleging this divine commission and listen to their patter, it would be clear that they all spent their childhood in the wilderness with traditional people who had never seen whites, and they learned secrets that had been hidden for thousands of years. It would be exceedingly interesting to compare this roster with tribal employment roles of 2 decades ago, because a good many of the names would be the same. Yet this alleged background is so irresistible to many whites that even what blatant frauds are exposed, most of them cling to the belief that they have met a real traditional Indian. The situation, however, is far from hopeless. On the reservations, we are seeing amazing resiliency in restoring the old ceremonies. A massive shift in allegiance is occurring in most tribes away from Christianity and secularism and back towards the traditional ways. A surprisingly high percentage of Native American clergy are also doing traditional ceremonies, and urban area churches are often the scene of traditional healing ceremonies. The Native American clergy are to be congratulated for their efforts to bring the two religious traditions together, but it is clear that no synthesis will take place. In almost every instance, the effect of merging the two traditions is to bring attention to traditional ways to the detriment of the particular Christian denomination. The result is that the semblance of a national Indian religion is being born that incorporates major Indian themes. As people are sensitized to this new religious milieu, being dissatisfied with the lack of specificity in this religious activity, they return to the more precise practices of their own tribes. Thus, it appears that traditional religions in some form will transcend the inroads that contemporary American culture has made. So there, I wrap up by saying that, you know, the specificity of the activity returned to the more precise practices of their own tribes. So seeing the lesson of Christianity that got spread thin and sort of economically, politically nationalized on and horrified on the global scene, in a way, this is saying, you know, sure, it's nice to study other traditions, but in a way, go home and find your own tradition, find your own cultural traditions, you know, go back to find your own indigenous roots or whatever, however you do it. But, you know, it's great to learn from others, but, you know, we each kind of thrust back to ourselves would make a huge difference. And in a way, that's for many years been sort of my idealistic answer to the world politics is just sort of this going out and out and out to other countries and fucking things up. So it's like when will they come back into themselves and start, you know, start to really learn something? But of course, that's the age old question. So thanks for listening, and looks like the last few chapters will make the part 6 of this series, and I got a bunch of highlighted things in there, and again, as he touched on in this section, talking about the importance of the ceremonies and what that means on many levels. So thanks for listening. Have a good one. And we'll go out with a little segment here from an album. Goes way back, George Carlin, Class Clown, called Confession.
I could do Father Burns so well that I often wanted to do him in confession, you know? I wanted to get into Father Burns' confessional one Saturday, maybe a half hour before he showed up, and get in there and hear a few confessions, you know? Because I knew, according to my faith and religion, that if anyone came in there and really thought I was Father Byrne, and really wanted to be forgiven, and performed the penance I had assigned, they would have been forgiven, man. Because that's what they taught us. It's what's in your mind that counts. Your intentions. That's how we'll judge you. What you want to do. Mortal sin had to be a grievous offense, sufficient reflection, and full consent of the will. You had to wanna. In fact, wanna was a sin all by itself. Thou shalt not wanna. If you woke up in the morning and you said, I'm going down to 42nd Street and commit a mortal sin. Save your car fare. You did it, man. Absolutely. It was a sin for you to want to feel up Ellen. It was a sin for you to plan to feel up Ellen. It was a sin for you to figure out a place to feel up Ellen. It was a sin to take Ellen to the place to feel her up. It was a sin to try to feel her up. And it was a sin to feel her up. There was six sins in one feel, man. Confession had another, there was another aspect to confession for me. Our neighborhood was right between Columbia University and Harlem, Juilliard School of Music, Grant's Tomb, two seminaries, Jewish Theological and Union Theological Seminary. I said Harlem was there, and then to the north, a Puerto Rican and Cuban section. And as Puerto Ricans began to move into our neighborhood, the diocese, in this rare display of tokenism in the early 50s, sent one Spanish priest, Father Rivera, to hear Spanish confessions. And all the Irish guys that were heavily into puberty would go to confession to Father Rivera. Because he didn't seem to understand the sins, you know? Or at least he didn't take them personally, you know? It wasn't an affront to him. It was no big theological harangue. He didn't chew you out. He was known as a light penance. In and out, three Hail Marys, you're back on the street with Father Rivera, man. You could see the line move. That's how fast he was working. But he wasn't ready for the way Irish boys were confessing at that time in that place.
Huh? Well, bless me, Father, for I've sinned. I would have touched myself in an impure manner. I was impure, impurity and impureness. Thought, word, and deed, body, touch, impure, sex, dirty. Impure legs, impureness, touch, impure dirty body, sex, rub, and covet. Heavy on the covet, Father.
That's okay, men. Tres Ave Marias. You'd be home in 5 minutes, huh? The Irish priest, on the other hand, nice guy, but first of all, he recognized your voice, because you'd grown up there, right? He knew everyone. What'd you do that for, George? Oh, God, he knows, man. And the Irish priests were always heavily into penance and punishment, you know? They'd give you a couple of novenas to do, a 9 First Fridays, 5 First Saturdays, Stations of the Cross, a trip to Lourdes, wow. That was one of the things that bothered me a little about my religion, was that conflict between pain and pleasure, you know? Because they were always pushing for pain, and you were always pulling for pleasure, man.